From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and some big health news out today. European regulators have given a green light to the world's first malaria vaccine.
It's a major advance in the fight against a disease that kills more than 500,000 people every year, and the vast majority of those who die, children living in sub-Saharan Africa. British drug maker GlaxoSmithKline has been working on a malaria vaccine for 30 years in recent partnership with the PATH Malaria Vaccine Initiative, a nonprofit group. And their new vaccine, called RTSS or Mosquirix, has proven partially effective in African clinical trials, but the results were less positive in extremely young children. We're joined now by Carla Botting. She's managing director of the RTSS project with the PATH Malaria Vaccine Initiative. Carla, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, how significant of an achievement would you characterize this new vaccine as being?
Well, I think the announcement today is a huge historic event, and this is the first ever malaria vaccine to reach this point. It was given a positive scientific opinion by the European Medicines Agency, which is the lead regulatory authority in Europe. The opinion was to enable the use of the product in children 6 weeks to 17 months in sub-Saharan Africa. Although it won't be used in Europe, the European agency was able to give an opinion, and now the national regulatory authorities in the countries that may use it will be the ones that will ultimately give the official nod for approval and use.
Right. So, before we talk more about the vaccine itself, I wonder if you could describe to us just how devastating malaria is in places like sub-Saharan Africa. We see the numbers that 500,000 people are killed a year by this disease. But what effect does it really have if you're living in sub-Saharan Africa or parts of Asia?
Well, I think, you don't really realize the impact until you're actually there on the ground. The hospitals, they have a list of the top diseases that affect their particular hospital, and malaria is always generally in the top three. As you mentioned, there was over 500,000 deaths a year, and there's 2 million plus cases a year also of malaria. And the cases alone often mean that a parent will have to stay home with a sick child for several days at a time. And there's also a significant economic burden, not just for the hospitalization of the children, but also because the parents need to stay home from work in order to care for their children, and not to mention the fact that their child is severely ill.
Right. I'm just trying to help us imagine about what would go on in North America, Canada, the United States, and Mexico and Central America, if in this part of the world, 2 million people a year came down with one very, very devastating illness. There would be a great deal of attention paid to it, and that is essentially what happens every year in sub-Saharan Africa. Africa and parts of Asia. And as you said, children are especially vulnerable. But the vaccine, though, if I understand correctly, has actually had quite mixed results for very young babies.
The vaccine, as you may be aware or may not, we studied the vaccine on top of existing interventions. And so there was two age groups in the study. One was in children 6 to 12 weeks, and the other was in children age 5 to 17 months. And the younger age group did have lower efficacy than the older age group. However, I think it's important to take a look at the context of the vaccine. Just to give you an example, when you immunized on average 1,000 people in the clinical trial, there was approximately 980 cases on average prevented in those individuals. So almost one case per 1,000, and that was in the younger age group. In the older age group receiving the booster dose, there was about 1,700 cases prevented per 1,000. And the range was pretty significant. So in lower disease burden areas, it was about 200 per 1,000. But it went all the way up to over 6,500 cases prevented in per 1,000. So children were getting about 7 cases over the course of the 4-year period. And the vaccine was able to prevent that number of cases.
So if I may ask, you are with the PATH Malaria Vaccine Initiative. That's a nonprofit group. This new vaccine was developed in partnership with GlaxoSmithKline. It's taken decades because it's the first vaccine for human use on parasitic infection. So I imagine that the research was rather complicated. What's the cost of the vaccine going to be? Is GlaxoSmithKline taking any profit from it?
So Glaxo has indicated, I mean, the price question is really up to Glaxo, but they have indicated that they would provide the vaccine at a not-for-profit price. And so they're not planning to take profit off the vaccine.
Mm. Well, finally, you know, the historic nature of this vaccine, duly noted, but also, I mean, it's still not 100% effective, as we've been talking about. So going forward, what do you see as sort of the best combination of treatments to prevent as many cases of malaria as we possibly can?
So I think that one of the things that is important to mention is that obviously we've met this huge milestone, this regulatory hurdle, but it's only one step in the process. The World Health Organization is the next step on the process. Well, they'll be making a policy recommendation. It's clear that we will need to continue to use bed nets, spraying, drugs. We're working closely with the other organizations that are deploying these interventions to ensure that there's the optimal mix of these interventions.
Mm, so bed nets definitely still matter.
Absolutely.
Well, Carla Botting is Managing Director of the RTSS Project at the PATH Malaria Vaccine Initiative. Carla Botting, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, authorities in Lafayette, Louisiana, are still looking for the motive after a 59-year-old man stood up in a movie theater and started firing into the crowd. Two people were killed and at least 9 people were wounded in last night's attack during a showing of the film Trainwreck. The gunman who killed himself was identified today as John Russell Hauser. Police Chief Jim Kraft described him as a drifter from Alabama who'd been in Lafayette since earlier this month.
It is apparent that he was intent on shooting and then escaping. What happened is the quick law enforcement response forced him back into the theater, at which time he shot himself. As far as we know, one .40 caliber handgun is involved. That weapon has been recovered. It appears that at least 13 rounds were fired during the time he was in the theater discharging the weapon.
President Obama was on his way to Africa when he got word of the shootings. He offered his thoughts and prayers to the community and the families of those killed. Before he left the White House, the president recorded an interview with the BBC. He was asked about a number of issues, including his trip to Kenya, where his father was born, the Iran nuclear deal, and the fight against ISIS. He was also asked what he thinks the unfinished business of his presidency is, specifically on guns and race. Here's what he said.
There was never a promise that race relations in America would be entirely resolved during my presidency or anybody's presidency. I mean, this has been a running thread and fault line in American life and American politics since its founding. And so some of the most recent concerns around policing and mass incarcerations are legitimate and deserve intense attention, and I feel that we are moving the ball forward on those issues. What I will say is that 8 years, after 8 years of my presidency, that children growing up during these 8 years will have a different view of race relations in this country and what's possible. Black children, white children, Latino children, America is becoming more diverse. It's becoming more tolerant as a consequence. There's more interactions between groups. There are going to be tensions that arise. But if you look at my daughter's generation, they have an attitude about race that's entirely different than even my generation. And that's all for the good. You mentioned the issue of guns. That is an area where, if you ask me where has been the one area where I feel that I've been most frustrated and most stymied, It is the fact that the United States of America is the one advanced nation on earth in which we do not have sufficient common sense gun safety laws, even in the face of repeated mass killings. And, you know, if you look at the number of Americans killed since 9/11 by terrorism, it's less than 100. If you look at the number that have been killed by gun violence, it's in the tens of thousands. And for us not to be able to resolve that issue has been something that is distressing, but it is not something that I intend to stop working on in the remaining 18 months.
President Obama speaking with the BBC yesterday. That interview was recorded before the attack in Lafayette, Louisiana at the movie theater. There's a link to the full interview from President Obama at hereandnow.org. Here's a question that's worth asking every now and then. Do you like your job? Do you enjoy work? It's a question Wes Moore explores in his book. He is African American. He grew up in Baltimore, had a difficult childhood. But as he wrote in his book, The Other Wes Moore, he turned his life around, going from Oxford to the White House, Wall Street to Afghanistan. His latest book is called The Work, My Search for a Life That Matters. It's out in paperback this week. We spoke with Wes Moore when it was first published. Wes Moore, I want to sort of approach this interview as if I'm interviewing somebody who might one day be the president of the United States, because as I'm reading this and I'm looking at you, a Rhodes Scholar, you've served in the military, you've interned in all
these different... I thought we were friends. Why would you ever wish that upon me?
Well, let me ask you, though, about something that you start with here, and that is you're arriving in Oxford to be a Rhodes Scholar. You're 23 years old. This is right after 9/11. How did that event, 9/11... and being abroad right afterwards, shape your view of the United States?
You know, I think there were really two things that genuinely happened. One is you have a much greater appreciation for your country, for its path, for its destiny, for the fact that we are one of the most remarkable experiments in human history. But at the same time, you also – one of the big takeaways is that, you know, the U.S. does not have the market cornered on good ideas.
What are you thinking of when you tell me that? Is there a specific example you're thinking of where we don't have the rest of the world has some idea that we don't have?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for everything from the way we think about energy to the way that we think about, you know, service and employment to the way we think about the college transition, you know, I think, for example, you look at the, you know, some things that are happening right now with Europe and the way they think about higher ed, you know, part of the frustration that I think that I see within the systems that we have right now is we have such siloed systems in the way that we think about education in this country, where you have the K-12 and then you have higher ed and then you have, you know, the post-secondary. But we don't have those same kind of bridges that are able to translate how those things work. And I think if we're able to look at things from that realm, we realize how quickly those national boundaries tend to dissolve.
One of the other things you talk about in this book, especially when talking about living abroad, is code switching, which is something that you say you learned early on growing up in Baltimore in order to blend in with both kids in the neighborhood that you grew up with, as well as some more privileged kids perhaps that you went to school with, and that you then had to do that again when you were an African American living abroad.
Yes. And you know, it's amazing because it's one of these things that you realize that you're doing without even realizing that you're doing it. Where the way that you talk, the way that you carry yourself, the things that you'll say, the things that you'll even think might happen to change based on the environment that you're in. And now part of it is a basic survival technique, right? I mean, you know, part of it isn't necessarily I want to fit in better here, fit in better there. Part of it does come down to the fact that if you want to, you know, keep your sense of self as to where you are, these are just some basic things that you have to do. You know,
like
but
what?
At the same So for example, I mean, you know, you can even look at some basic examples like, you know, the way I talk to my friends is not the way that I talk to my grandmother, right? I mean, the words that I would use, the way you react to certain things. One thing I saw when I was going to school, I was living at that time living in the Bronx. And my mother had was working three jobs because she did not feel comfortable with the school that I was going to in New York. So she then sent me away to a private school across town on the other side of the Bronx. And I very quickly found myself being, you know, too poor. And then I very quickly found myself being too rich for the kids in my neighborhood who now didn't understand why the schools that, you know, that everyone else attended was somehow, you know, quote unquote, not good enough for me. And so what you do is you almost become this chameleon. The danger of it is that you then find yourself not even understanding who you are.
Well, when it comes to understanding who you are, and as you are switching over the course of all these experiences, you're going from internship to the military to Rhodes Scholarship to a job on Wall Street to whatever it might be, were you able ever to answer that question, you know, what do you want to be in 5 years during all of that? Or did you just sort of go with the flow?
Well, I think part of it was that I had to actually start to think differently about even how you answer that question. Do you know, because I think part of the challenge that I even had when I was coming up, and I think a lot of kids have this problem, is you don't think long term. You know, I remember one experience where I was with one of my mentors from the Johns Hopkins University, the former president. And when I told him I was going back to Wall Street, and I was excited because I thought he'd be excited about this job I'd have working in finance. And his response was, "Really?"
Yeah.
And I was kind of taken back by his reaction. And he asked me why I wanted to do it. And I explained to him that, you know, I wanted to build a skill set and, you know, I wanted to support my family and do all these things that my family never had a chance to do. And he kind of stopped me and he said, "Listen, Wes, you know, I guess I understand I'm never going to, you know, cast judgment on you as to the decisions you make. But the only thing I ask is that once you feel like you've accomplished everything that you need to accomplish there, you need to leave. Because if you're doing something that is not what you're supposed to be doing, then with every day longer you stay, you become extraordinarily ordinary." And when he said that, it really hit me because the goal is never to be extraordinarily ordinary. The goal is to capture what it is that makes you special.
Wes Moore, you've had a lot of mentors throughout your life, and the one that you speak really eloquently about in this book is your grandfather, who
Yes.
passed away, and you were in Afghanistan and were not able to make it back in time. But tell us what he meant to you. You write here, "My father had been my Moses, bringing me to life. Then my grandfather became my Joshua, carrying me through my childhood and teen years into adulthood."
He was one of the most important people in my life, and actually one of my great disappointments in my life is that I didn't see it or appreciate it until I got older. This was a man who was actually born inside the United States, was born in South Carolina, and when he was just 4 years old, 5 years old, the Ku Klux Klan actually ran the family out of not just South Carolina, but out of the United States, and they moved to Jamaica. And his father was a minister. He later on became a minister as well. In fact, he became the first black minister in the history of the Dutch Reformed Church. And the thing that I so admired and still do admire about him was he was so confident and certain about who he was. He knew he was here for the ministry. He knew that he had his calling and that was the calling he was going to follow. And it wasn't something that came with heavy prestige. It wasn't something that came with large paychecks. But it was something where he was fulfilling what it is that he was supposed to do.
What has he taught you about what you want to be for your grandkids?
I think he's taught me that the most important thing that you can do is simply to be present, that your example matters. The most important question that anyone will ever ask you, and that my grandfather asked me, was, "Who will you fight for? You know, who will you stand for and stand with when it's not easy or when it's not popular? Who will you advocate for when it's not convenient? Who will you stand shoulder to shoulder with when it might just be you too, but you're doing it because it's the right thing to do?" And I think so much of finding your work and finding where your greatest joys and passions overlap with the world's greatest needs and you choose to do something about it is answering that exact question. Who will you stand for? Because when you find that, you will find your greatest joy and you'll find your point of being here in the first place.
Wes Moore, before I let you go, I want to just ask you a couple of quick lightning round questions, just in case you ever do run for president, and then we'll be able to go back and listen to the answers.
You got it.
Well, you're an Afghanistan veteran. Do you think that that war was a good idea?
I think that the response to Afghanistan was a good idea because whenever you cannot have a state that is openly and willingly harboring those who are actively attacking your nation and not have a response. I think, though, the response that we had to it, and especially the response that we had to the later war, Iraq, was part of the problem, part of the erosion of not just the operations, but also the civil conversation about it as well.
Do you think Wall Street, and you've got some complex views on Wall Street in this book, do you think that in general today it is doing more good or bad for Americans?
I think that adding liquidity to the financial system is useful, but I think we need to have much more restraints and barriers as to what that means and what it looks like. I think that if you look at some of the things that caused 2008 to happen, the fact that we still have a lot of things in place that led to a lot of these things that still have yet to be addressed is a fundamental problem, not just the way that Wall Street works, but the way our larger economic system works.
Who's your favorite president?
My favorite president is Lyndon Johnson. And I say that because
he's the creator of public broadcasting.
He's the creator of public broadcasting. The first thing I was going to say. The second thing that I was going to say is when you look at the large scale ideas of progress, you know, and you look at Lyndon Johnson, also I'll throw Harry Truman on there as well. Some of the most longstanding and important national initiatives and long lasting national initiatives have come under those presidents. And another reason why I say LBJ is I don't know if we've seen an evolution of a president so stark as we've seen of LBJ. You know, who LBJ was when he was in the Senate eventually became a very different man than he was when he went to the White House. And oftentimes there's almost this pride of saying, well, I said this 45 years ago and I say the same thing now, which I never quite understand because, you know, when a new information is introduced, it's completely understandable that your views can evolve. And I think LBJ was someone who symbolized that, that as new information was introduced, particularly around things like, you know, income disparity, housing and civil rights, his views evolved. And I respect that.
Wes Moore, his book is The Work, My Search for a Life That Matters. Do you have any idea what you're going to run for first?
PTA president.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's what I want.
No, that's great. Wes Moore, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We spoke with Wes Moore in January. His book is out in paperback this week. We've got an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Researchers at Oregon State University are developing a new strain of seaweed that is said to have twice the nutritional value of kale, but tastes like bacon. Joining us from Portland is Michael Morrissey. He's professor of food science at Oregon State and director of the Food Innovation Center there. Michael, welcome.
It's good to be here, Jeremy.
And does it taste like bacon to you?
It has a kind of a savory taste. You know, again, fresh dulse has its own unique taste. It's kind of more of an, you know, like seaweed, more of kind of an fresh ocean type taste. When you fry it up and cook it in a certain way or smoke it, it can have a more of a savory flavor, a more of a meaty flavor. Some folks say it, you know, it's kind of has bacon notes to it. It kind of depends how you appreciate your savory flavors, I think.
And when you use that word dulse, that's a kind of seaweed.
It is. It's a red macroalgae, and it's harvested in the wild in Maine and off Ireland and Scotland and Scandinavia. What's different with our dulse is that Chris Langdon, the researcher at the Hatfield Marine Science Center on the coast, he's developed a certain strain of dulse grown in aquaculture in these conditions, these 5,000-liter tanks, and he's developed a certain strain that grows quite quickly. It'll kind of double its weight in about every 10 days or so.
And what's the texture like? Does it feel like bacon in your mouth?
I would say texture-wise, no. It's kind of a seaweed-type texture, a bit soft, probably not bacon-like.
And what about this claim that it is better for you than kale?
It has a lot of, it's, you know, great attributes. As a lot of seafood products, especially seaweeds, have. It is, you know, very high in a lot of the B vitamins, higher protein content than kale as well. Certainly in many of the minerals, because seaweeds are known, or sea vegetables are known for taking up minerals from the water. So things like iodine, potassium, calcium. So it's a great nutritional source.
And we hear that the chefs where you are in Portland are starting to experiment with this. Are they making, what, DLT sandwiches, dulse, lettuce, and tomato, or what kind of things are they doing?
Oh, they're mixing with salads. They're, you know, using as a kind of a side dish with oftentimes with seafood dishes. Seaweed is commonly used in Asian cuisines, but we're really trying to introduce it a bit more to the North American palate and North American type dishes.
So this is something that you're looking into there at the Food Innovation Center. What other kind of innovations are you coming out with these days?
Oh, we do quite a bit here. We work a lot with food entrepreneurs. They're pretty inventive themselves. There's a company here called Salt and Straw Ice Cream that is pretty inventive. Different flavors such as pear and blue cheese, brown beer and bacon, and things that you would never dream of combining together in an ice cream is pretty amazing.
Do you feel a little like Willy Wonka?
A little bit, yeah. I would say no 2 days are alike here at the Food Innovation Center, and that's, it keeps you hopping. There's no question about that.
Well, Michael Morrissey, a professor of food science at Oregon State University and director of the Food Innovation Center there, thank you for joining us, and have some of that bacon seaweed for us.
Maybe tomorrow morning. Eggs and dulse would be a nice combination.
Okay.
Thank you, Jeremy.
On July 5th, Americans rejoiced when the U.S. women won the World Cup, beating out 23 teams for soccer's greatest prize. But at the same time, in Chiang Mai, Thailand, another American team was competing for victory. But instead of taking on 23 teams, this one took on 103 other countries. And they won. For the first time since 1994, six American teenagers won the International Mathematical Olympiad, edging out frontrunner China in a grueling battle of the minds. And joining us to talk about their victory are two members of the team, 18-year-old Ryan Allweiss from New Jersey. Ryan, welcome.
Hello, thanks for welcoming me.
And 18-year-old Yang Lu from St. Louis. Yang, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us is their coach, Po Shen Lo, who joins us from Seattle. Po Shen, welcome to Here and Now as well.
Hello. Thanks very much.
So first of all, gentlemen, if I can say congratulations on your triumph. We're all very proud of you. But what does it feel like to be world champion mathematicians?
So the moment we found out that we won, most of the U.S. team was downstairs in the lobby of our hotel. So what happens is, right after they finish deciding all the results, the IMO people upload them all on IMO Official. So we checked the page, we refreshed it a bunch of times, finally it showed up, we clicked country results, USA was on top. We all just started screaming and yelling that the U.S. won. So it felt pretty amazing.
And amazing because, I mean, did it surprise you or did you have confidence that you could
win?
So
we heard some rumors that we did very strong on day one because, like, it's a two-day contest. We also heard that our day two was maybe not as strong. So we thought it would be close. But seeing the confirmation and our name on top of the scoreboard was really special.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great victory. Po Shen, may I ask you, for people who aren't familiar with the Mathematical Olympiad, I mean, what did your team need to do to win?
Absolutely. So what they had to do is they had to solve just a few questions, six questions, and they had 9 hours to do so. The only catch is that in order to solve any one of them, you do have to be a little bit of a genius. So in some sense, there are many countries in the world who even struggle to solve just a few. In the United States, we're fortunate to have a fairly strong mathematical program and the Math Association of America. So I would say that in order to solve these questions, in some sense, one doesn't need to know too much advanced math beyond what's in high school. In fact, you don't even need to know calculus. But you have to think much harder about that math. And the analogy I often give to help listeners understand what's going on is that when you look at Olympic sprinters, in some sense, they're just running. My kids know how to run. But there's a lot more to running in the sense that you could actually deeply understand and even train your body how to drive far quicker, far faster than anyone who's an amateur or just a casual practitioner, so to speak.
So you said that there's six problems, right?
Yes.
And is it done by sort of rounds or do the teams have to solve all six problems and then you find out who wins?
So there are actually 2 days. Mm-hmm. So on each day, you actually have 4.5 hours and 3 of the problems. And you work independently on those on day one, and then you work independently on the next 3 on day 2. And your final score as an individual is the sum of your scores across both days.
Yeah. Well, just for people listening, I thought I might read one of the problems from this year's competition just to sort of get a sense about how or what kind of challenges you faced. I've got one here. It asks you guys to determine all triples, A, B, C, of positive integers such that each of the numbers, AB minus C, BC minus A, CA minus B, is a power of 2. So what's the answer?
Oh, God.
I'll take this one. So Ryan is saying, oh, God, because in the contest, he did not find all the answers. So he's still a bit salty about this. This problem has four answers, excluding like permuting the variable. So like 2-2-2 works if all the variables are 2. 2-2-3 works. Or like if you change the order, it still works because all the variables are the same. 3-5-7 works and 2-6-11 works. These are the four answers.
Is 2-2-2 a legitimate answer though? Because it's asking for A, B, C. I presume that it meant three different integers for each triple.
No, they can be the same.
Okay.
Yeah, they can be the same integer, yeah.
All right, because 2-2-2 did pop into my mind as the first answer, but that seems to be the most obvious one.
Yeah.
And how did you go about solving it?
Well, once I got this problem, I actually immediately first did the situation where two of the variables are equal, because I thought this like might jumpstart some ideas. So once I tried this, I went through some of the algebra, and I got that 2-2-2 and 2-2-3 were the only answers when two of them are equal. So I think in general to solve this problem, what you kind of have to do is you have to show, you have to prove that when A, B, C are all large, then they can't all be powers of 2. Kind of a good way to think about this is powers of 2 are like, there's not too many of them. They only happen like very rarely, right? After 1024, the next one's already in the 2000s.
Right.
What you try to show is if A, B, and C are all too large, then they can't all be powers of 2 because powers of 2s are like very spaced out.
Wow. Well, let's take a step back for a second and give listeners' brains a little bit of a break here. Ryan, I mean, how long have you loved mathematics?
For as long as I can remember.
And what is it that you love about it so much?
Oh, God. Okay. This question. All right. So it's hard to describe this to people who don't do math, but there's this sort of ineffable beauty with mathematics. It feels very good when you solve a problem. It feels like you've accessed this kind of truth. And it's very fun to try all the approaches. Some might not work, some might. So it's like a puzzle. You're working at something and you get to something.
I kind of see it like, I don't know, some sort of like digging or mining. Like most of the time when you're digging for jewels or gold, you're kind of searching around, but you're most likely not to find anything. But like, if you start digging in the right direction, you might find that new idea. And then that's like the gem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's no doubt that the thrill that comes through a really bracing intellectual challenge, and then, of course, the discovery of the solution is kind of a unique one. But then you take that into the competition space, though, and the stakes get even higher. So, I mean, so Po Shen, I mean, how do you train for an international Olympiad like this?
Sure. Well, I should say that a lot of the training is actually done by the students themselves. Although I'm the coach, in some sense, my main objective is to attempt to inspire them as much as possible, because I feel that in this day and age where resources are everywhere on the internet, you could actually drive yourself to an extremely high level even if you didn't have an in-person coach. However, what an in-person coach hopefully can provide is some sort of inspiration to cause you to want to do this. And so my goal is actually to try to communicate to as many people as possible how interesting all of these things are to do. And at the end of the day, they will go far beyond me. For example, all of the team that have been representing the United States in the past few years are much stronger than what I am. And in some sense, it's not what I can teach them that's valuable. It's what I can maybe communicate to them about the point of what's going on that is useful.
Let's talk for a second, if we can, about who you beat, and that's China. Did that make this this victory even more sweet, or does it not really matter who you beat and just the fact that you won?
China's been the perennial winner of the IMO. They lost in, I think, 2003, 2007, and 2012. But other than that, they've won basically every IMO in recent memory. So winning the IMO, in our minds, is kind of equivalent to beating China, because it's extremely unlikely that we'll beat China and then some other country will beat China and then also beat us. So in our minds, sort of winning the IMO and beating China go hand in hand, because China always, quote unquote, always wins.
But I mean, I guess I'm cheating, right? Because I overheard you guys say earlier that you've had interview requests from Chinese media.
Yeah, I can take that one. So it is true that after the United States IMO victory, I did get some calls from Chinese newspapers who were curious about how the United States training operated. And so I was very happy to communicate to them that in some sense, what we're doing is we're running a system where the success of the system is based on people's free choices to excel in mathematics, coupled with the fact that there are resources to learn mathematics everywhere available for free. So we've reached a certain convergence point at which I think that this free approach is going to work marvelously.
And Ryan and Young, you're both 18, so what's coming next for you?
We're actually both going to MIT. So the other four members of the team, two are also going to college on the other side of Cambridge, and then two are going to be still in high school for another year.
Well, congratulations on that. I'm sure MIT will looks forward to having you on campus. Well, Poshen Lo is a professor of mathematics at Carnegie Mellon University. He's also coach of the U.S. Mathematics Olympiad team. Poshen Lo, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
And Ryan Allweis and Yang Liu are members of the 2015 gold medal winning team. Ryan and Yang, congratulations again, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
This week, Cuba reopened its embassy in Washington for the first time in more than 50 years. The U.S. will soon do the same in Havana. They're important symbolic steps in the slow thawing of relations between the two countries. But what do these new developments mean for the average Cuban? Well, Henry Louis Taylor Jr. is the director of the Center for Urban Studies at SUNY Buffalo. He has traveled to Cuba every year for the past 15 years to meet with Cuban citizens and talk with them about their lives. He's also author of the book Inside El Barrio, a bottom-up view of neighborhood life in Castro's Cuba, and he joins us from Buffalo. Professor Taylor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you think the view is from the barrio about the warming of relations between the U.S. and Cuba?
I think people are very excited about it, and they hope that it will be an opportunity that will make their lives a lot better. Life down on the ground in Cuba has been very difficult. Cuba's a very poor country with limited resources. So they see the warming of relationships as an opportunity that will help them, both in terms of the increased number of tourists coming into the country, which gives them an opportunity to engage in certain economic activities. Secondly, in terms of the increased amounts of remittances that are able to come into the country from abroad.
So clearly, the potential for an economic boon to the people of Cuba is there, with these sort of more open doors between the two countries. But doesn't it seem as if that boon sort of disproportionately goes to certain Cubans over others? I mean, I'm seeing that remittances from the United States, most of that goes to white Cubans.
It's a situation where the racism that we find inside of the United States spawns inequalities 90 miles away in Cuba. Also, in Cuba, self-employment has become increasingly important in that society. The country simply does not have the resources to absorb large sections of the population within its public sector. Mm-hmm. And so only those folks that have sources of revenue that can help carry them during difficult times make it. So in its own way, the remittances, while it brings much-needed dollars and resources into the society, begins to create cleavages between the races by making it possible for one group of whites who get those remittances to have a higher standard of living than others.
Right. So I have to say, it's very interesting to hear you say that, though this isn't guaranteed, there's the possibility that one impact of warming diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba is that the inequities that we see in this country could be exported, perhaps, to Cuba. So what could the United States do to make sure that doesn't happen, that the Cuban people, again, in the barrio, you know, as referenced in the title of your book, are actually helped by this deal?
I think the single most important thing is to really promote authentic education and cultural exchanges. Here in Buffalo, I'm working with a team of ministers and physicians around the decentralization of healthcare services. We believe that we can learn a great deal from the Cubans about their neighborhood-level health systems that has built a strong decentralized distribution of healthcare services. As people interact with Cuba, as they become to appreciate many of the significant and important types of things that they've done on the social front, when we come back, we can advocate for the perseverance of those policies inside of the United States. So I think building these relationships across boundaries, creating opportunities for us to engage in joint ventures so that people to people, we get to know, appreciate each other. I think that's the best way that we can help the Cubans preserve those things that are important, and the best way that we can support the battle against policies that will be destabilizing and harmful to the country.
Well, Henry Louis Taylor Jr. is the director of the Center for Urban Studies at SUNY Buffalo in New York and author of Inside El Barrio, a bottom-up view of neighborhood life in Castro's Cuba. Professor Taylor, true pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.